Matthew chapter 24. Matthew chapter 24. We began just kind of in the way of introduction last week into this chapter. We have been well over 4 years in the book of Matthew, and judging by what is how long it's taken us, it would probably be maybe another couple of years until we get all the way through. But I'm excited about Matthew 24 and 25, as I've already told you, because of the content. And so let me just remind you that Jesus has been at the point that we're about to read. In fact, let's just go ahead and read it. Chapter 24, let's go with verse 1. It says, "And Jesus went out and departed from the temple, and his disciples came to him to show him the buildings of the temple. And Jesus said unto them, See ye not all of these things? Verily I say unto you, there shall not be left here one stone upon another that shall not be thrown down." So I'll just remind you again that Jesus has been in the temple, he and his disciples, all day long. He was giving the last public teaching of his life. And it's taken up almost the last three chapters, at least two and a half chapters, half of 21, and in verse 20, chapter 22 and 23, were all a part of that that teaching, mostly directing a lot of his very tough words towards condemning the actions of the scribes and the Pharisees, but also along the way giving a lot of information about the kingdom and how his kingdom functioned. And then ultimately there towards the end, as we studied just a few weeks ago, passing judgment upon Israel altogether. And so now at this point that we're reading in chapter 24, he's just stepped out of the temple. It says there in verse 1 that he went out and departed from the temple. So he's left the temple building, and he's outside, and his disciples are pointing back to the temple, okay? Notice what it says, that his disciples came to him for to show him the buildings of the temple. And so in essence, they're calling his attention to the buildings that they just left, they're just kind of saying, look at this, okay, kind of deal. If you were to read the parallel passages to this over in Mark chapter 13 or in Luke 21, there's a little more detail there. Essentially, they're admiring the temple complex. They're pointing it out to him, pointing out his beauty, commenting about the magnificence of the structure. And Luke 21 and verse 5 tells us that they spoke more specifically about the stones of the temple, okay? Now, some of the stones of the temple, well, the whole thing was quite impressive, I'm sure. But some of the stones of the temple, the foundation stones that were used to build it, were actually 40 foot long by 12 foot high and 12 foot wide. And that was one stone quarried in a single piece, several miles. It would have had to have been quarried several miles away from Jerusalem and then transported to the building site. And so that was just that in itself, just those stones would be quite an engineering feat at that day and time, okay? And so let alone the whole temple complex. It was just very impressive. Now, keep in mind, just for the sake of learning here, this is not the temple, the original first temple that Solomon built, okay? That was built some 950 years prior, and it was just a magnificent complex itself. And you can read about that over in 1 Kings chapter 7 and 8 and 9, right through there. It gives a lot of the description, and it must have been some kind of a building project. Okay, that temple lasted about 370 years, and then was finally burned by the Babylonian king Nebuchadnezzar. And then 70 years after that, I use the word reconstructive, but I don't know exactly. It wasn't totally demolished the first time, so I don't know whether there's a certain amount of it was salvaged or not, but it was reconstructed, and that was authorized by King Cyrus, a Persian king, and that is known as, okay, the first one's known as Solomon's Temple. This one's known as Zerubbabel's Temple, and simply because Zerubbabel was a Jewish leader that was given the oversight of that project. And so he was kind of a superintendent, if you will, of that project, and so his name stuck. He led the rebuilding of that, and then that was more of an inferior type temple, okay? It never would have had the great magnificence of the first one, nor the one we're about to, that we're reading about. But it stood for about 500 years, this Zerubbabel's more inferior type temple, until it was replaced by what is known as Herod's temple, and that's the one we're reading about here. Herod's temple began about 20 years prior to the birth of Jesus, and its construction continued about 30 years after the death of Jesus. Okay, so we're looking at somewhere around 80 years for full completion of that Herod's temple, the temple complex. Okay, now King Herod was a Roman governor. We've learned a lot about him along the way, that oversaw that region of Palestine. Okay, and so he was called King Herod, but he was actually a governor, and he had oversight of all of that, and he had this temple built basically to appease the Jews, to keep them happy. And so it was a very enormous complex. The whole, everything involved with it, we'll talk about some details in just a few moments, but it was cream colored. There were many structures involved with this. Okay, this is the temple that the disciples are admiring in this particular text. But you got to keep in mind, they were just admiring the main temple building. That they're calling attention, it says buildings, actually, plural, in verse 1. So you know the main building they're speaking of is the one they had just been in with Jesus. And then, of course, there were surrounding buildings, and then there were many that were not finished yet. But that one building was just breathtaking in and of itself. Just doing a little research today, it was, and just this is an estimate, okay, but it was about 500 yards long, 5 football fields, running north and south, and about 350 yards wide. And so that's just the temple building itself. That's not taking in all the other buildings in the temple complex, okay? And there were that building had been completed, okay, by the time Jesus and the time we're reading about. But the surrounding, remember, it took another many years, 30 or so years after this, before it was all completed. And that would have involved the massive walls that were around the temple complex, gates, the towers, the porches, and the other buildings associated with it. There was even, and I didn't know this, but within the temple complex, there was a place for Roman soldiers, actually, where they stayed on site in the complex. And I didn't know that till I studied this out a little bit. So there again, all of this is taking place, but it was a breathtaking thing to see, even in its unfinished state there. Especially though the temple, and they're pointing that out to Jesus. They're admiring this building that they've just left, and it was constructed of white stone, had a lot of gold, inlaid gold in it, and it's said that in its full glory, under the sunlight or in the sunlight, that it was almost, you could almost not look upon it. It was so bright and glaring from the sunlight. And so it was just quite a deal. And so they're looking at this, verse 1, and they're saying something to Jesus about admiring it and pointing out the enormity of it, I'm sure, and perhaps they're kind of wondering in their mind how this colossal structure could ever be left desolate. And that's exactly what Jesus had just said just a few verses before. Notice verse 38 of 23. Remember this? He said, "Behold, your house is left unto you desolate." He's talking about Jerusalem and everything in Jerusalem. We already studied that out, so I won't go back over that. But he's basically declaring, as we've already learned, that, hey, this is all going to be laid waste. That's what the word desolate simply means. And that was a prophecy that was, in fact, fulfilled in 40 years. When the Romans came in there and basically burned Jerusalem from one end to the other, including the temple, everything, just pretty much everything was destroyed. And so, but the disciples, if you were one of the disciples and you were standing there looking at this tremendous architectural masterpiece, if you will, it would have been very hard for them to imagine what kind of event could possibly take place that would lay this thing to waste or leave it in ruins. I mean, it would be kind of, how in the world could this happen? So Jesus goes on and he reiterates what he already has declared in verse 38 of the last chapter, and he expounds upon the extent of the desolation. He says in verse 2, he says, "See not all these things? Verily I say unto you, there shall not be left one stone upon another that shall not be thrown down." So he just reiterates the desolation, the degree of desolation. History again tells us that that took place in AD 70 when the Romans came in there and burned and laid the temple in ruins and the rest of Jerusalem along with it. It was so utterly destroyed that visitors to the area could not believe that it had ever been inhabited. That's how bad it was destroyed. So it was truly a pile of rubble. The only thing I could liken this to in my limited mind here would be if you and I were standing outside the Twin Towers in New York City on September the 10th, 2001, looking up and admiring these colossal structures, the size of it, the beauty of it, the sheer amount of land it took, besides how high it stood vertically, and just kind of looking at the whole thing, and some guy next to us nudged us and says, "Tomorrow this will be a pile of rubble." Can you imagine? You'd be like, "There's no way. There's no way that could happen." And of course we know the following morning it was. And so there again, it's not comparing apples to apples, but that you would kind of think that the disciples kind of might have had that mindset, that they're pointing out how beautiful and magnificent and enormous it is, and then Jesus says this is going to be laid level here pretty quick. And so it would be hard for them to imagine that it was possible. So the disciples had that mindset, I'm sure, and they also know, though, that their Lord is truthful, and he's never misled them in any way, and he wouldn't mislead them anyway. So they know what he's saying has to be true, but they still having a hard time reconciling it. So it causes them to ask this question, verse 3. "And as he sat upon the Mount of Olives, the disciples came to him privately, saying, Tell us, when shall these things be, and what shall be the sign of thy coming and the end of the world?" So, again, they're seated at the Mount of Olives. They're overlooking Jerusalem. The Mount of Olives rose up above Jerusalem. That would have put them on the east side of Jerusalem, where the Mount of Olives is to even today, with the sun setting on the west side of Jerusalem, opposite the city. So that would have been somewhat silhouetting the temple. And they're looking at that, and they want Jesus to explain, how's all this going to transpire? How's this going to fall into place? And the way they ask the question here kind of gives us a glimpse of how perplexed they were, because the question was kind of mixed there. First of all, they said, when shall these things be? They're really responding to his most recent comments, the things that he's just said. He's saying, when Jerusalem's going to be made desolate, the temple complex is going to be completely laid waste. When is this going to unfold, Jesus? Is kind of what the question was. And then they said, what will be the sign of thy coming? That word coming is in Greek is parousia. It simply means, when is it going to be manifest? And so it's not that they're asking about his return, but the word coming would make us think they're asking about his return. Well, they don't even know about his departure yet, so they're not asking about the return. It's really an inquiry of the timing of, when are you going to fully be fully manifest as the king and this kingdom? When is this all going to, when will you be presented as the Messiah, is what they're asking there. And then the third part of the question is, what shall be the sign of the end of the world? In other words, what are going to be the signs of the end, the things that we, things as we know it? When things change, they're not talking about the destruction of the world. They're inquiring, when is everything we know it going to go away and this new kingdom going to appear or become a reality to us? And so at this point, they're just really confused, and you could understand why. And they could have probably very easily asked a blanket question of, look, Jesus, we don't have a clue what you're talking about. Would you please explain? And that would have been, it probably accomplished everything those three questions accomplished, okay? But Jesus knew their thoughts. He knew their apprehensions and their confusion. So in response to their questions, in response to what they did ask, he embarks on a sermon. We know this to be the Olivet Discourse, okay? We talked about that last week, but it's simply named that because it was preached on the Mount of Olives. He takes the remainder of chapter 24 and all of chapter 25, 93 verses that are in red, and he gives the longest answer to any question ever given in the Bible. And in this, it's coming, obviously coming from his own lips, the lips of Jesus. It's a description of the end time events that surround his everything involved with his second coming, okay? And so there are a lot of other places in the Bible that you can study about the return of Christ and the end time events. Obviously, we've done that along the way here and there. But there's a lot of insight to be gained in Revelation and Daniel and Thessalonians and stuff, a lot there. But this is the most detailed and easiest to understand of all of it. The truths that are found here in these two chapters are essential to understanding or comprehending, if you will, the subject as a whole. You can't hardly reconcile all the rest of it without these two. And the Lord is the one describing it. It's the greatest part about it. Because who better to explain the return of Christ than the one who's going to be doing the returning? And it's our Lord. And so it's a great study. I've studied it before on my own a couple of times. And there's some tricky things in there, a little tough on a teacher, but we'll work through them, okay? And so next time we're together, we'll see what we can find out about that, okay? Appreciate you guys so much. Let's go ahead and stand and be dismissed, and look forward to seeing your Sunday choir. I'm excited about hearing from you guys. It's going to be good. And so we'll be praying for you between now and then. And again, keep these folks that have been mentioned in prayer, especially Steve Christofferson, okay? He and Bridget need our prayers, okay? All right, good deal. Let's be dismissed. Chad, will you lead us in prayer, please?